Hey yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. I am Mo, and I'm joined once again by the King of the Casters, Mr. Brett Podcast. And Brett, we have a very special guest.
That's right, we do. He's a guest that I've been a fan of for quite a long time now. Canadian, which, you know, Canadian treasure, I'm going to say. He is got a new album coming out called Both Sides on April 5th. Welcome to the show, Mark Jordan.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Mark Jordan. We're going to go through a bit of your history for the listeners.
Okay.
You know, obviously, you know, go through many of the different accomplishments. You've written for certainly iconic people, Diana Ross, Cher, Bette Midler, Chicago, some gentleman named Rod Stewart, I believe, who I think has a future. Rhythm of the Heart went worldwide everywhere. As a top hit. This is a song you had previously recorded yourself. And when somebody takes one of your songs, do you prefer it to be, would you prefer to write a new song for somebody, or do you enjoy seeing somebody else's interpretation of your work?
Well, it's a funny thing. There are two ways to do it. When I started off as a recording artist. So when you're a recording artist, everything is for yourself. You think of how these songs would be truthful coming out of your mouth. And when I moved to L.A., I was a staff writer for a while for Warner Chappell and then for a couple of other publishers. And that's like a different thing, because if someone says, Madonna is looking for a song or whoever, there were guys on staff there that could go, oh yeah, like that, I know exactly what she wants, and they could write that, but I never could do that. I always had to pretend that the songs were for me, and that was the only way I could make them sort of ring true. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it always had to feel like it was for me, and then I wasn't pretending to be someone else.
Now, do you feel the same way when you look at, in the case of Both Sides, do you feel that way when you're choosing covers that you're going to, or songs that you're going to cover?
Well, I only do covers that I really can connect with, you know? I mean, these are songs, the songs on this record are songs that I've wanted to sing for years and years, and, you know, my father was a singer with orchestras and big bands and stuff in the 40s, and there a couple of songs are, you know, like both, like What Are You Doing for the Rest of Your Life and things like that, The Nearness of You are songs that he sang, and I grew up with those songs, so I know how to sing them.
Do you start well before then, before you start recording the album, do you already have an idea as you listen to the songs over the years of how you would interpret it? Or is it all kind of at the time you've chosen the songs and you're working on the album, that's when your arrangement comes out?
Well, that's pretty well when the arrangement happens, because as you can probably imagine, there are so many ways to do any song, really. Like, you could take a Beach Boys song, like God Only Knows, and you could do it just like the Beach Boys, or you could do that song with a single guitar, you know, and slow it down, and it almost becomes another song. But you still have to maintain what the song is about. You know, you can't just arrange something anyway. It has to work with the song. It's hard to explain. It's not really a science. You have to feel it in the studio. You have to feel that it's right.
Now you have 9 tracks on this album. I imagine then that there was a lot of tracks that you had considered, a lot of songs you had considered for the album that didn't make it, or was it pretty easy to get down to this 9?
Well, we started out, we were maybe considering about, 13 or 14 songs, excuse me, and Lou Pomonte and I, and Lou is the arranger and producer, and so we just sat down at the piano, and we went over each song, and if I could make it work vocally, then it was really a consideration. And then we did mock up for the stuff we did with orchestra. We mocked up the tracks on computers, and then if it still felt good, we went to the next step. If it didn't feel good, we sort of stopped there, and we came out with the 9 that really worked.
So yeah, you talk about being comfortable vocally, and I had read a little bit about you not wanting to perform one of your songs live that Joe Cocker had done because you would just sound kind of like a wimp in comparison.
Yeah.
Must be a real consideration for you? Like, you know, at what point are you comfortable, and at what point is there a real point where you just know that you're not comfortable?
Yeah, and it's hard to explain what that is. Sometimes it has to do with the range. Sometimes it has to do. See, when a singer sings a song, sometimes they'll bring something to the song that wasn't even maybe in the song at the beginning. Like a lot of people, like Madeline Peru, for instance, has done a few Bob Dylan songs, and she does them so beautifully that they're almost unrecognizable as Bob Dylan songs. That song Both Sides Now that I did on the record, Joni Mitchell did it when she was 18, and she did it when she was about 60, and it's a different song when she was 60. So when Joe Cocker cut this song that I wrote, what was it called now? I'm trying to think of it. Oh yeah, Take Me Home. And he did it for a movie, and you should see it on YouTube. It's so powerful that it really almost, like, Joe Cocker's a monster. He was a monster singer, and he made the song better than it was. You know what I'm saying? It was so wonderful to hear his voice on it. When I tried to do it, I sounded like a weenie, you know. I didn't get the buzz from it that I got when I heard Joe Cocker sing it. So I never recorded it live.
Well, I fear anybody's ego if they try and compare themselves to Joe Cocker. That's not. You're not going to come out on the winning end on that one, I'm afraid, if you're comparing.
You ain't going to win that one.
No. Yeah, no, that'll be a blow to your ego every time if you're comparing yourself to him. So a lot of the songs, of course, they are kind of slower interpretations, some jazz influences on there, obviously. Does that create a lot of, is there a lot of pressure then to convey the emotion with your voice then? Because that's what really comes across to me about it is how well you're able to emotionally convey a message in these songs.
Well, I think I'm not sure. I don't do that consciously. I think what I do is I try to get inside the song, and I try to become emotionally involved in the song. And I think if I'm not just phoning it in, if I'm emotionally involved in the song, and I try to sing songs that touch me and mean something to me, and hopefully they'll mean something to other people. If I can get inside it and convey that, then I think the audience can feel that. That's been my experience anyway.
So I'm interested. You started out and you were a guitarist for Bobby V. Now, when you're writing a song, do you write that song on the piano? Like, is the piano like your first instrument, or would a guitar be your first instrument?
Well, I learned to play piano before I learned to play guitar, but I didn't really, when I started writing songs for records, it was after, it was really after I heard Bob Dylan, I think. That's when I knew I could write songs, and so I played the guitar. I picked up the guitar and I learned the guitar, although Rhythm of My Heart was co-written, but I started that song on piano, and so I guess I've gone back and forth a little bit. But I usually co-write now. I mostly co-write. And I try to get people, you know, that are much better players than I am to work with, you know.
Now, how important was it for you to have a musical family? Because, I mean, we know a lot of musicians and I hear different stories, but it strikes me that you probably get a more fuller sense of music. And in your case, especially knowing the big band songs and being able to go back so far, but being able to play the piano and play the guitar, you know, how important was that?
Well, I think any child that grows up, their parents are, you know, they take what their parents do and what their parents do for a living, and that's sort of normal. So I thought, my dad had a radio show. He used to sing when he came back to Canada, he used to sing on a show on CBC. And when I was a little kid, I thought every dad had a show, you know? But it was only, you know, so that was my normal. So that, it was very helpful, I guess. It was easy for me to make the leap into music, even when, you know, it was hard to make a living. Like, it was really, at the beginning, it was very, very hard, you know, to make it, like, to even to feed yourself, basically.
Yeah.
You know, when I started out, I started out as a folk singer in Toronto. It was crazy. Murray McLaughlin has a funny story. When he started out, he said he used to, do you know, there's a place called Allen Gardens where they have, like, those glass greenhouses.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And Murray McLaughlin says he was so poor that he used to put margarine on a piece of bread and pretend it was a sandwich and then go down to those greenhouses and walk in and pretend he was on holiday in Miami.
Yeah, I guess that whatever gets you through, right?
Yeah.
Well, and you've really taken the family thing, you know, even further now. Because, I mean, both your children, I mean, obviously your wife, Amy Sky, and both of your children are musicians. It's funny because Amy's actually the reason that I got into you, because.
Oh.
I heard, I used to work at a music store, and I got the Cool Rain, it was 1996, and I got the Cool Rain CD, and I wound up listening to it, and I thought, this is awesome, and I was digging through the liner notes, and I'm like, oh, she's married to Mark Jordan, he's a musician too, so I just started digging in, and I'm like, oh, this is great, and so yeah, wow. That was essentially how I got into you.
Well, you know, that's how we all used to discover music, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we listen to something and say, oh, I love that guitar player. And then you'd listen to that. And yeah, that was, I love music stores. You know, I love going to music stores and rifling through the records and, you know, finding what I could find. And that was a lot of fun.
Well, now YouTube does that for you. It just suggests the next song based on your last one.
But, you know, the unfortunate thing now is that You know, in music stores, and I think back then, like, I always tried my best to understand a lot about any kind of music so that I could converse, you know, somewhat intelligently with anybody about anything. I mean, I would get into conversations about Yeah or with Yes and, you know, all sorts of different bands. But, and I think that's something that you lose now when you, with a YouTube. You're not going to get into an interesting conversation about Count Basie with YouTube.
No, that's something lost and something gained, I guess. You know, the act that's phenomenal, but you know, you gotta. I guess if you want to learn anything, you have to dig.
Yeah, it's true. I'm interested in when we talk about the songs on both sides. Now, they're quite, you know, fairly long, usually in the like 4 to 7 minute range. Whereas, you know, on traditional like pop radio now, we're so used to songs that are in the 3 to 4 minute range. Now, is that kind of like a jazz radio element, or was just that a feeling for you where it was just like, nope, this is the right time to end the song?
Well, in songs like Both Sides, it's just a hell of a long song. You know, it really is a long song. And we thought, well, should we cut out verses? And then when we tried to cut out a verse, it wasn't as good. So we just did the long version, you know. And things like What Do You, I'm trying to think. Well, we also put solos in things, in some songs where there weren't. I mean, the solo in Walk on the Wild Side is probably longer than it was on the record. And we did the song slightly slower, so it is slightly longer than the original. You know, Randy Brecker played on the record, and it was so, we were so pleased with what he played that we kept sticking him on more songs. you know, so you can't have a 10-second solo, you know, it has to be what it is. He's a great player, though, that guy.
Yeah, I mean, there's some great, great musicianship on the album for sure.
And Lou Pamonti did a wonderful job. He did some great arrangements with the strings, and we used the Prague Symphony Orchestra, and we just tie-lined them into the studio.
What is it about somebody that intrigues you about playing with them, or a project that intrigues you about getting involved in it?
The
symphony, or just somebody you see that you think you'd like to work with. What is it that just, I guess, is it an emotional thing? Is it cerebral?
Yes, I think it is. I heard a couple of records one that Lou did, and I forget the other one, who the artist was, but and I looked, and it was the Prague Symphony, and I thought, these guys are great. And then I thought that it would be very expensive, and like, you'd have to go over there. And I just inquired, and Lou said, no, we'll just tie line them into my studio, and we can do it all in real time. So it worked out really well. We did the bed tracks in Toronto. And that's my wife beaming in, by the way.
Say hello.
I did the bed tracks in Toronto, and we gave them a click, and then we tie-lined them in the studio, and there they were in Prague, and we were in Toronto. It was great.
So I would like to get a little bit more of the history of you, because we talk about knowing that you play guitar for Bobby V, but we're not sure kind of the timeline exactly of when you got there, how that occurred, and because, of course, I mean, he had so many legendary hits, and largely in the 60s, and what yeah. you may have learned from him, and that how long you were with him, that type of thing.
Well, Bobby V used to come up here and play the Strip. You know, the old, I'm trying to say, like Cock Door and places like that on the Yonge Street Strip. And he was like a bubblegum guy. You know, he had like bubblegum hits, like a rubber ball often bouncing back to you and stuff like that. And I had a band, we had a band, it wasn't my band, but I started out in a cover band, you know, just trying to make ends meet. And one of the guys, the keyboard player, Bill Cudmore, was somehow contacted by Bobby V's people and said, we're looking for a backup band when Bobby's in Toronto. And he was an interesting guy because he actually was a really good songwriter. But he got trapped by his own success. And he was, you know, when he started, he was from, I think, Fargo or something. North Dakota or Minnesota or something like that. And Bob Dylan at one time was in his band. And when he was a young guy, and then he got, you know, more into the songwriting, and he wrote these teeny bopper songs. But after he'd had his hits, he was writing some really great songs, but every time he tried to play them, his audience didn't want to hear them. They only wanted to hear his hit, his hits. And he was sort of a little bit bitter about that. I remember that. It was a bit sad because he was kind of trapped, you know, by this early success that he had had. But he was fun to play with, and he was a lovely guy.
Did he teach you anything about the industry or songwriting or anything like that that you kind of carried forward?
Well, he was certainly a professional, and he made sure we were really rehearsed, and I saw how he arranged things, and he was the first really professional, like American type professional guy I'd worked with. And it was just another level for me. And he was very good at arranging and telling people what parts to play, and which I never really thought of. Everything was a bit of a jam when I played, you know. But he was very organized, and then when he played the stuff that he couldn't play for his audience, they were really good songs, but. It was just what it is. It just was what it was.
So then you had a few songs that were released through CBS in Canada, I believe. And went to, you signed then with Warner, as you say, and were working the songwriting department. And in the late 70s, and you had a few singles that came up to Canada, even though you were living in the States. Is that right?
Yeah, I moved to California in 1977. And I got a deal with Warner Brothers.
And then you had... go ahead, please.
And I was signed by Gary Katz, who was a Steely Dan's producer. And I did a couple of records for Warner Brothers.
And then you were down there for a while, mainly as a songwriter, I suppose... While you were working for Warner, or was it kind of an equal split between songwriting?
Well, I did these records, and they did okay, but they weren't. I never had a big hit, you know. So like things like Marina Del Rey were regional hits. It was a hit in California, it was a hit in Florida, and they played it in Texas, and they played it in Canada, but. But what happened was that people started recording my songs, other artists. And I was more successful that way, it was more successful than I was as a recording artist.
Mm.
So when people started doing my songs, the publishing companies got interested in me, and they started offering me big deals. And so when I did my two albums for Warner, and when I wasn't on Warner Brothers Records anymore, I went to Warner Brothers Publishing, Warner Chappell in those days. And then I just started getting successful doing that. And so I kept doing it for quite a while.
So what was the first song then that somebody else recorded that you heard, wow, this person is going to record one of my songs? That's really cool. This is somebody I really have a lot of respect for, or.
Well, it was Diana Ross. And I remember I had a 68 Oldsmobile Cutlass convertible with a torn convertible top. Like, you could stick your head through the top of the car. I was literally driving down Hollywood Boulevard and listening to the radio, and then I heard Diana Ross singing my song, and it was a big moment for me. I had to pull over because, you know, I grew up with Diana Ross and the Supremes, so it was really a thrill for me. And then I wrote with her after that too, which was really wonderful. She was a wonderful person, and I really very fond of her.
Are there lots of people that you've had I mean, your career is amazing, and like, are there lots of people that you've had the opportunity to write with that are kind of those people where it's just like, wow, how did I get here, sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's all wonderful. Rod still sends me stuff, and he'll send me a track, you know, with him sort of mumbling over it or singing weird, sort of a rough melody, and you know, I know he's just doing it at home, and those are quite amazing to have, you know, those rough things. And then he'll say, you know, can you fix this, or can you put words to it, or, you know, so that happens, you know, every now and then, and it's an amazing thing. I just love, because I love him, you know, I love his voice, and he's had one of the biggest careers in the world, really, if you think about it.
Oh, for sure.
How many years he's been doing it.
And such a wonderful performer.
He still comes to Toronto and pulls 35,000 people.
Yeah.
Yeah, we saw him in Santana a couple of years ago together, and
wow.
It's an incredible night. It's an amazing night.
Yeah, he's, you know, and I think it worked with him in particular, because when I was a kid, I listened to a lot of Sam Cooke. And I think I never asked Rod if he did this, but I'll bet he did too, because he does a lot of the same licks that Sam Cooke does, and so do I.
Mm. You know,
big influence. I mean, I used to, you know what I used to do? I had a radio when I was a kid. I had a radio, and I took a wire from the little aerial on the back of the radio, and I attached it to the drain pipe of our house. And so our house became like a big aerial, this radio. And so they didn't play much black music in Toronto in those days. But I could get, you know, I could get New Orleans. If there was a storm in Cincinnati, I could get New Orleans because of that drain pipe, you know. And so I listened to a lot of music that was hard to get up here.
That's really interesting Yeah, that's cool. I know that the new album has a version of the Curtis Mayfield classic, People Get Ready.
Yeah.
And I think the Rod Stewart version is probably the version at least I'm most familiar with. So when I saw that you had done a version of it as well, it just kind of felt in some way full circle to me.
Yes, for me too. I love that song. It's such a great song. And Curtis Mayfield, of course, brilliant guy. And it was just, you know, that was some of the stuff that I was hearing. And all the black music that you know, a lot of it came out of the church in the South. And you just didn't get that. You didn't get that up here. You do now, but you didn't, you know, you didn't hear that in the 50s and 60s. But thanks to the drain pipe on the side of my house, I could get New York and even some gospel, you know, gospel radio. I didn't even know what it was. It was just church music from, you know, like Alabama and stuff like that. It's amazing. Blew my mind.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've been doing a lot of reading about race music and like especially the Chitlin circuit that occurred back in those days, you know, in the like and how that evolved over time. So yeah, to hear that you were able to kind of pick up some of that is really awesome.
Oh, it was wonderful. It's just mind blowing for me.
Yeah, I mean the stories are just amazing. Like just the lives and the people. I mean we think about it now, like, you know, some of the people, like, you know, being able to talk to you, but then like being able to, you know, you think about the Wolf and like Muddy Waters and all these guys and then going even further back. I mean, just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And there were, you know, guys like Alan Lomax and the few people that recorded these guys, you know, back, you know, in their hotel rooms or their motel rooms, it just recorded them on, you know, on these primitive tape recorders, and it's just an amazing record to have, you know, like Hughie Ledbetter and, you know, stuff that you wouldn't have had otherwise. And it's they're historical documents as much as anything else.
I've sometimes heard those old recordings, and the quality isn't good, and yet somehow that to me makes it better. I don't know how to quite explain it, but it gives it a certain a unique context. Quality. Yeah, you know,
gives it context, absolutely. It gives it a stamp, a time stamp, you know, I just enjoy listening to it, and I'm, you know, I'm just glad it's been digitized and it's there forever now.
You obviously music. I mean, your love of music is obvious, and I know you're writing music still all the time, correct? And I'm kind of curious. Yep. You know, how many songs do you go back to? Do you go back to them and think they're finished and they're not finished? Do you continue to work on them? Do you put them aside after a while and just move on to the next thing? What kind of happens to the library of older songs that you have?
Well, I keep them all around. Some of them I write and I call them breeder songs because I know they're not perfect. But I'll keep them around, and then I cannibalize them. You know, I take bits from them if they'll work in other songs or something in the idea, you know. There was a song I wrote years ago, it is on Spotify, actually, called Burning Down the Amazon. And I wrote it in the early 80s. When they were slashing and burning, the government down there was slashing and burning. They were trying to make farms out of the Amazon jungle, which is basically the lungs of the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's where most of the oxygen comes from.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And they were burning the fucking thing down. Excuse me.
No, you can say it. It's okay. It's a podcast. Go ahead. We're disappointed if you don't swear.
All right. Don't get me started. Anyway, they were burning it down, and people were just going nuts. And I had a song called Amazon, but it was before I learned about what was happening. But I just wrote about it, the vastness of it, and I wrote that song. It was about 3 or 4 years old, and then I adapted it. For this thing that was going on in the Amazon jungle, and we did a huge recording of it at Capitol Records in that beautiful studio in the Capitol building, and it was amazing. Mr. and I can't even remember all the people we had come down and sing on it. It was really something. It was wonderful. And I'll tell you a funny story. Aldous Huxley, I lived in Beechwood Canyon, and Aldous Huxley, he was dead, but he lived up in Beechwood Canyon too. And, his wife still lived there, although he was dead. And I met her. I don't remember exactly how I met her, but I met her, and she invited me into her house. And so she was showing me all sorts of amazing things and Aldous's. And when we were doing Burning Down the Amazon at Capitol, because it was close, I invited her down because she loved to sing. And she said, "Well, where is it?" And I said, "It's at the Capitol studio, right down the bottom of the hill here." And she said, "Oh, I love that building. Aldous and I used to drop acid there." Isn't that funny?
That's fantastic. That is definitely not where I thought you were going. That's fantastic. Wow.
Oh, that is amazing.
God. That was crazy. Oh, wow. She came down too.
That's so wonderful. Oh.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
And your imitation of her is great too.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely adds to the telling.
So you, it was the early 90s then you moved back to Canada, is that correct then? And what was the reason why?
Well, we were having babies, and Amy wanted, you know, I met Amy in L.A., but, you know, she was from Toronto, so she wanted to be around her family, and as we both did, but we also wanted to bring up our kids in Canada. Mm. And call me crazy, but
nope, being Canadian, we won't call you crazy.
No. And we also believed, you know, a lot of our friends were having trouble with their kids down there. Mm-hmm. When they got to be school age, and there's a big problem. Big problem down there with the schooling. And you got to essentially send your kid to a private school, and we didn't want to do that. It wasn't a money thing, but we wanted our kids to be around all kinds of different kids. We didn't want to send our kids to a school where they were only around their own, you know, white kids and with the same socioeconomic background. We wanted our kids to go to school with, you know, every color and every religion, and just, you know what I'm saying? And so when kids play together, it doesn't matter what you are. You know, they accept you. And I think that's a big problem in America, where they separate kids and they grow up not integrating with each other. And it's a tragic thing, I think.
Now, with your wife, Amy Sky, you certainly did very well for yourself. Where did you two first meet then?
Well, Amy was living in Nashville. And she was in Nashville for 6 years, and she wanted to come back to Toronto. And her friend said, well, on your way back to Toronto, go through L.A. and write with this guy, John Capek, who was my writing partner. And so she did. She got with John, and she was writing songs with John for about a week. And John had a barbecue, and you know, with, and he invited, because John, I met John in Toronto. He was he's Australian, but via Toronto. And so I he had a like a Canadian. He invited all his Canadian friends, like Dan Hill was there. I remember. Oh, gee, a lot of Canadians anyway, and so Amy was there, and we started talking, and the rest, as they say, is history.
It's a small world, isn't it? She's yeah. Obviously a fantastic songwriter in her own right. How much of a resource is she for you over the years as a writer, as a songwriter?
Well, you know, we don't write a lot of songs together, but when we get stuck, she'll come to me, and when I get stuck, I'll come to her, and I'll tell you one story you know, she came up. I you know Stephen Macchio?
Yep.
Well, he and I wrote a song called Tears of Hercules that a number of people have recorded, but I got a call to David Foster, and he said, you know, I'm producing Josh Groban, and he wants to do Tears of Hercules. So I said, fantastic. So he said, let me put Josh on. So I'm on the phone with Josh, and he said, I love this song, Tears of Hercules. I said, fantastic. He said, I'm going to record it. He said, but you gotta change one thing for me. He said, you got to get rid of Hercules. I went, oh, well, okay. and I thought that was the end of that, because I tried to think of something, and I couldn't. And but then I realized, you know, in Canada, we think of Hercules as the myth of Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
In America, there was a cartoon.
Oh, that's his problem with it. Okay.
There was a cartoon called Hercules.
Oh, man.
So, Herc, I remember.
So to Josh Brolin, it was like Tears of Daffy Duck. And I couldn't think of another title for it. And my wife came up with My Heart Was Home Again. So Josh loved that and wrote and sang and recorded it under that title, My Heart Is Home Again, which worked out great. So Amy helps me, and sometimes I can help her with a line or two, you know, and it works out pretty well.
So I'm really interested because you know, knowing all these people that you know and how you hang out, like there's a picture on your website of traveling with Olivia Newton-John and her husband. And I'm wondering, like, what do you talk about with other musicians when you're just hanging around with them? Is there like a shop talk, or do you talk about the old musicians that you enjoyed, or do you just not want to talk about music at all?
We usually just talk about me. I kind of dominate. You know what? Like, we often talk about shop, I guess. what do you think about it? Talk about, if I'm with a bunch of guys, I, you know, talk about gear, and but you know, we all have families, and you know, Olivia's, I've known her since the early 70s, and she's a lovely human being, and we just talk, you know, we get to see each other every few years, but sometimes not even that often. But you pick up right where you left off, because we're in this, you know, she's very successful, but we're basically in the same business.
I'd say you're definitely in the same business. I'm wondering, if I ever went to Alan's, what should I get for lunch on the menu?
Whatever their special is usually pretty good.
Yeah.
That's where the name came from.
Yeah, I was listening to the Lunch and Allen's, the different songs. What strikes me as a Canadian is it feels so Canadiana, you know, what you guys do and there, and that, I don't know, it gives me a, yeah, I suppose it would for anybody. It's not so much a patriotic feel as a sense of comfort.
Well, you know, our musical heritage is very different than America. So, our music is different, and you know, certainly Murray McLaughlin exemplifies that sort of folk tradition that most of, you know, is the bedrock of most Canadian big time hits, you know, for the last 50 years, I guess. And American music, you know, comes from the African influence. You know, our heritage is more British, and so the music is different. And when you hear it, and it's lovely. I love doing Lunch and Allen's. I have so much respect for Murray and Ian and Cindy. They're just they're really fantastic writers, I have to say, and performers too. I've learned a lot from them.
Yeah, I mean these kind of things, they're just so much fun to be able to listen to, and I'm sure they must be an enormous amount of fun to do as well.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's hilarious.
We do
have a good time.
Now, I'm, you know, you've been so generous with your time, I'm sure we could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but
break down songwriting, yeah, more and influences for days. I hate the feeling, but love talking about these things.
Yeah, I mean, we got a few more questions if you're okay with that. And,
I'm good. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I was also reading. You had talked about, what was it? I think it was a Swedish Elvis impersonator that did a cover of Rhythm of My Heart. and you had said that was the worst. So by that token, I'm interested in overall, what do you think are some of the best covers that people have done of your songs?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, Rod, I must say that Rod did a great cover of Rhythm of My Heart, and that's part of the reason it was a hit, because he did a great version of it. Bette Midler did a song of mine called, I'm spacing on the title of it. I can't think of the title, but The Perfect Kiss, it was called. And she did a beautiful version of it on her record, but then she invited me down. She was singing at Maple Leaf Gardens. I think it was Maple Leaf Gardens, and so they buzzed me in. And as I was walking behind the bleachers, she stepped out of her dressing room and she sang the song a cappella to me in that big cavernous space, and it echoed all over.
Oh, you're and kidding.
No, it was so beautiful. Made me cry.
Now that's incredible. Oh.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
You know, honestly, we're such huge fans of music as a whole, but when you hear stories like that, it just adds a new level, you know?
Yeah, what a sweet thing to do, you know? I gotta tell you, you hear stories of people, and most, I would say 99% of the big name people that I've worked with are just lovely people. They really are generous, and you know, and they're just wonderful. I mean, I heard a whole lot of stories about Diana Ross, you know, about how tough she was on people, but I have to say she was just sweet and lovely to me anyway, and so I've been blessed for sure.
Well, I'm interested too, because so you've got some shows coming up starting in April, going into May, all in Ontario. Do you think that you'll be trying to come across Canada at all? I mean, I know I'd love to see you get the chance to see you perform in this case. So come to Calgary, you know. Hint.
I'll come anywhere where people want to see me, and I've got with Sean Terrell Promotions now, Productions, who started off booking us with Lunch at Allen's, but they're booking me now, and they're terrific, and I would like to go right across Canada if I can, and it just depends on if the record, you know, if it captures people's imagination, and I can put people in the seats, you know. I never used to love to play, but I love it now. I just love doing it, and I think it's such a wonderful thing to share with an audience, and audiences are so damn generous, and I just love doing it.
Do you wind up telling stories while you're doing shows? Is it kind of like do a song? We saw John Hiatt and Lyle Lovett perform, and that's what they did, was they kind of, you know, would tell a story, tell a few jokes, and then do a song. It was such an interesting organic evening.
Yeah, I do quite a bit of talking, you know, depending on where I am, but. I also read a couple. I also have a couple of poems that go with songs, and in Ontario, I'm a painter as well. In Ontario, I often, like for instance, I'm doing I'm playing in at the Gravenhurst Opera Theater on the 5th of April, and. I also have an art show there too, which is fun, because then you get to meet people before and after the show, and it's nice to have that interaction. You know, music is a great thing. It's a great thing. It's a very healing thing, and I don't want to sound too new age here, but it is. It speaks to a part of our humanity that I don't think any other art form does, and I believe it's an instrument of peace, and I believe it's a wonderful shared experience to go and listen to someone sing songs. I really do. You know, so I love it.
Does painting creatively, does it scratch the same itch or a similar itch for you, or is it a completely different thing?
Well, I'm not, I say I'm a painter, but if I'm not a trained painter, and I don't consider myself, you know, like I couldn't do a portrait, or, but I call it flat music, and it's the same part of my brain. It's just a different bunch of tools, you know. But it's very abstract and it's very lyrical. But to me, it's the same as music. It's using the same part of my brain. And so it feels nice to do it when I'm not doing music.
Yeah, I mean, some of your paintings, we were looking at them online. I mean, some of them, yeah, amazingly beautiful. Just the lines and stuff like that. Really, really nice.
So. Yeah, a lot of them are sort of surreal instruments and things like that. Guitars and then I have a canoe series. Yeah. I love canoes. It's the perfect technology. You
know? It really is, actually, when you mention it.
Oh yeah,
it's really simple and never be improved.
Yeah, it's
not really.
It's quite the dichotomy, though. The you know, some of the guitars, and then next to the canoes, and just it's like, wow, that's different. Oh well, thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time to talk with us. We're going to give you the chance to tell everybody where they can find your album Both Sides on April 5th, and also where they can get a hold of you.
Well, on April 5th, I'll be at I'll be in Gravenhurst, as I said, at the Opera House, and that's sort of the launch of it. But then in May, I start a bigger tour. Which is like Ottawa, Kingston, Collingwood, Owen Sound, Peterborough, Guelph, and Oshawa. So I'll be out of the road for, you know, 3 weeks or something like that. And then I guess the website is where I guess the record will be out, you know, in a couple of weeks. So markandmarkjordan.com.
And we're just double checking, just because we have actually from your people the date of April 6th and not April 5th for Gravenhurst. So we're just.
Oh, April 6th. Well, let me double check that then.
I'd hate somebody to show up on.
Absolutely want to get it right for people.
Yeah. Let me. You're so right to. Yeah, the Opera House is the 6th.
All right, good.
Okay,
good
stuff. Not
the fifth. Wow, I've been saying the 5th.
Uh-oh. What a win. April 6th, that'll be... That'll, I'm sure you'll still draw a great crowd. And you know, if you do come to Calgary, I tell you what, me and Brett want to see you here. So if that's enough people for you, come perform in his backyard. Brett will make barbecue.
I'll do it.
All right.
venue I would play, I guess, one of the small theater clubs there.
There's quite a few.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is quite a few.
Probably the Jack Singer.
I would think the Jack Singer concert will probably be a good fit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I'll try to do it. As I say, I have a new agent, and we'll see if we can get out there, because I'd love to do it.
That's wonderful. Well,
yeah, we'd love to be able to say hello in person, but... you know, honestly, I love talking to you. It was so interesting, and, you know, we learned so much. And I see that you're recording a duet with Amy for 2020, so hopefully we'll bring you on back on the show then.
Fantastic.
But Mark Jordan, thank you so much.
Feel free and bring her on, too.
That's right.
Yeah, I will. We'll do it together.
Awesome. But yeah, say hello to Amy for us, because big fans. Hello. And thank you so much for coming on. I hope that the album does amazingly well, and that the tour is ultra successful. You're a wonderful guest, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good night.
Okay. Good night. Thank you.
Bye.
came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked away across the USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and he was a she. She said, hey, baby,
take a walk on the wild side.
Take a walk on the wild side. Hey, honey,
take a walk on the wild side.
Take a walk on the wild side. Came out from Long Island. In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost a head, even when she was given it. She said, hey, sugar,
take a walk on the wild side.
She said, hey, baby,
take a walk on the wild side.
Take a walk on the wild side. Take a walk on the wild side.
Take a walk on the wild side.
And the colored girls go. Once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay and pay. A hustle here, a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe,
take a walk on the wild side.
Take a walk on the wild side. Yeah.
Take a walk on the wild side.
Take a walk on the wild side. Joe, take a walk on the wild side. She was James Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would help that bad. She said, hey baby,
hey baby,
take a walk on the wild side. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Take a walk on the wild side. My, take a walk on the wild side.